Right, anybody got any questions or points to make?
Comment,
yeah, okay.
With particular reference to the last thing that Steve was talking about, it's then quite interesting to look at what, say, the press call, mindless vandalism, or if there is now, if this is going to be it, then you can understand some people saying, I don't like it, and doing something quite outrageous. At least I think it's going to be.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that this whole kind of moral agenda that the political parties in this country are embarking upon, actually, consistently with most capitalist governments in the world, because the US has been infected by this kind of nonsense for a hell of a long time, and there are a lot of other people in a lot of other places even more obsessively wedded to these sort of moral agendas, is extraordinarily destructive. And one of the things that is most interesting about it is that what it is really trying to do is to get at anybody who acts in a disorderly way. And whilst I'm not suggesting that we somehow put up a defence for football hooligans, minors, drunks, or whoever else one wants to imagine as a kind of demon, one of the things to beware of is that as soon as you start targeting those particular groups within society, what you do is you don't get rid of those groups, they'll never get rid of those groups. What you do is you start making a legitimacy in targeting people. That's what it's actually about. And so what you therefore do is you create opportunities for greater and greater repression, greater and greater opportunities to freeze out marginal elements who are a disturbance to capital. And I think it's extremely important at an early stage to actually identify what's going on here, and at least through the limited opportunities that we have to communicate with people, to tell them what's going on.
I think your phrase, offensive human perfection, in a sense is no more applicable to any system than it is to capitalism. I think that as socialists, we need to draw attention to the fantastic utopians that capitalism today represents. In the sense that it's totally unrealistic if you know anything about the way the system operates and must operate. It's totally unrealistic to fantasize about the trickle-down theory as being something that will bring eventually wealth and welfare to everyone. And I think it's necessary for socialists to expose that kind of thing and really to present their own programme, not simply a utopian programme, but one to be unrealistic. I think it is a matter of strategy, it's very important to avoid the charge of indulging in fantastic utopia.
Well, I agree. I mean, I agree with part. I don't agree with it all. I mean, I agree with you that the whole point about the fantasy of human perfection, I mean, I have no objection whatsoever to the realization of human perfection if I knew what human perfection was. But there is actually a sort of an inherent totalitarianism about human perfection. Because my worry about human perfection is you actually start getting rid of the disabled people, you get rid of the people who are too short, too small, too fat. So I don't actually go along with that. I think you can have, you know, you can have a fantasy of white perfectionism or a fantasy of black perfectionism. You can have a fantasy of literate perfectionism. So I think you've actually got to look at those things. Now, I think you've got to know where it comes from. And where it comes, you know, the first thing that I do when I read one of the early utopias, or when I listen to John Lennon's Imagine, is not to say, oh, you're indulging in a fantasy of human perfectionism. My first thing is to say, yes, great, you know, good stuff. Actually, it shows that human beings do not repress within them this sense of wanting a cooperative, humane society, a society modelled on us. So from that point of view, I approve of it, but I see the dangers of it when it is purely that. Now, when you talk about socialism needing to be realizable, I mean, I think you're absolutely right, and I hope that's what I was saying, and that's why I brought in and the conclusion of my comments, the important wisdom that Marx brought to this, What Marx recognized was that without agency, without somebody to bring things about, nothing happens. You know, we cannot, I mean, you know, Fourier said, and I'm quoting, and I've got the quote written down here somewhere, but he said, you know, I alone will be responsible for liberating humanity. 4,000 years from now, people will be praising me as the man who liberated them. Now, you know, poor Fourier, who had this great utopia of sexual liberation and died, incidentally, a virgin, who had this great utopia of a moneyless world and spent his life as a commercial traveller selling things. You know, one feels sorry for him, you know, and if he wanted to reward himself with his great role in posterity, who am I to criticise him? But realistically, that's not how history changes. Realistically, it is no more possible for one person to bring about liberation than it was possible for Hitler to perpetuate tyranny. In the end, these things simply don't last. One person is smaller than the conditions around them. So I think that socialism has to be rooted partly in the utopian tradition, which it is whether we like it or not, but also within a strategic position of actually being able to encounter real powers that do exist, that are vested interests, that stand in the way. You know, in other words, there are not simply people out there who say, we don't agree with this as a utopian aspiration, and we have our own utopian aspiration, which is the trickle-down effect of capitalism. There are people out there who are saying, we are not going to allow this to happen, and we will use every resource that we need to use, should we need to use them, in order to stop it from happening. And one has to confront that politically, you know, in a realistic fashion, as you say.
Can I just come back to the picture? I mean, there is a difference, is, I think, between socialists, in some way perceived of as painting ideal future people, as distinct from socialists who are intent on proposing some kind of realistic way of maintaining sustainable development.
Yeah, but I mean, but yes, well, if that's your perception, and you know, I can see why you have that perception, but my perception is that you can't separate socialists in that way, and you can't separate the present and the future in that way either, because the present is always receding into the past, and no sooner are you thinking about what I'm saying now in the present than you're actually thinking about the past. It's philosophically impossible to ever think in the present. So we're always reflecting upon the past, and every action we take is going to be in the next few seconds, the next few weeks, or the next few years, sometimes presumably within our lives. So in that sense, we have to always negotiate with the past and the future. And all that it seems to me is the case is that it is useful when you go out and negotiate with the future that you keep your imagination switched on. And I think that is what the utopian tradition gives us, because there is a danger that you negotiate with the future to such an extent that you actually forget what it is that stimulated you to ever do anything.
Well, what about the argument that I thought was implicit in the question that we can turn the tables on the supporters of capitalism? I mean, you know, they say, you're socialist, you're utopian, so we turn to them and say, no, you're utopian.
Yeah. I don't favour that. Yeah, I picked that up and I should have... I don't, tactically, so to speak, I don't favour the argument that one ever accepts this term utopian as a disparaging term. I think many of us use it actually occasionally. And I know that in my own kind of area of research work in my professional life, periodically I look at something somebody proposes and I say, you know, this is clearly motivated by a utopian idea of what capitalism can achieve. But actually I think that's an unwise use of the term. I think we should preserve utopianism as being part of this longing of humankind for something better and decent, and should not actually accept that that's what capitalism has ever been motivated by. Capitalism has been a pragmatic social system born largely out of economic self-interest for groups of people. Now, they've seen economic self-interest, they've rationalized economic self-interest as being to do with the common good, with efficiency, with many other things. I don't believe that they believe it. I don't think that one has to actually tackle them on that level. The level that capitalism is best tackled on is a level of economic efficiency. And because it doesn't work for the majority of people, we should get rid of it. Frankly, if it did look like it could work for the majority of people, I wouldn't want to enter into sort of philosophical debates about whether something better could achieve. I'd say let's stick with it. But the starting point of the argument with capitalism is it doesn't work in the interest of the majority. Indeed, it works against the interest of the majority, and it exploits the majority in order to work for the interest of a minority. That being so, the broader sort of aesthetic arguments about the values of capitalism are less significant.
I want to return to Steve's discussion of the end of history. It seems to me that over the last 100 years, and I hope this doesn't sound too pessimistic, the idea of the end of history has actually grown extinct. Let's take 100 years ago. In a little book about socialism by a historian, she said that at the end of the 1890s, a lot of debate among socialists was the new society going to come by Christmas, or will we have to wait to the new century? This is just one example of the way in which there was a kind of feeling that change, you know, could come relatively soon. 50 years ago, my local Labour Party candidate was challenged by me, was challenged about socialism, and he said, yes, it's a fine idea. Yes, eventually, this is what we're going to have. But first of all, you've really got to, you know, get people, you've got to elect me, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And today, we have the Japanese economist Fukuyama, I'm sure that's not his proper pronunciation. He's the author of, right, the end of, you know, the book, The End of History.
Yeah, I do.
Right, now I think what's happening today is that we're not just being told that you can't have them change. I mean, it's a question of don't even think of change. And it seems to me, therefore, that we've got to somehow surmount the idea that, for example, the market system, research on globalization doesn't now talk about the possible challenge to the market system. Yes.
About genetics. But what we're talking about here is some American firm saying, we now own this gene that would take out a human being, and we own this. Now, up till now, this question of ownership has been looked upon almost God-given. You know, it's just like the air we breathe or the law of gravity. We never questioned the fact that things should be owned. But now, when planters in various parts of India are saying, wait a minute, you can make this plant that will taste the same as ours, just be a chemical and so on. And you're saying that you own the genes for this and that we'll not be allowed to grow it anymore. That this whole question of ownership all over the world has been questioned. And I take that, and almost every development of capitalism is thrown into relief the nonsense of ownership. And I think that more and more people are getting to grips with that idea. Not quickly enough, and not in an organised fashion. But nevertheless, I think that's a hopeful sign for all of us.
Funny you should mention something about the Human Genome Project, because we're discussing an article for preparing next month's Socialist Standard. And I just got in front of me two quotes from one of the people involved, and he's almost using the same language as we do. I mean, he says, this is Dr. Michael Dexter of the Wellcome Trust, the human genome sequence is a birthright of mankind and should be available to all. He insisted that it was the essence of mankind and should not be owned by one individual, one company, or one country. I mean, I was going to say it's utopian under capitalism, but I better not. Do you want to?
Well, one of the things, as far as getting tying the tool of production, not getting too far away from that, in all the anti-social acts today, I think it's most important. I got engaged in a discussion in Florida this winter. Florida, one of the states, along with California, where they're spending more now on the incarceration of prisoners than they are on education. This is the word a lot. London or somewhere.
Twisted.
Yeah. They're going to turn it over to private enterprise. I think this is one of the things that scare capitalists today. The three strikes and you're out, they thought this was going to be the cure all. now they're putting away some energy. And the cost, somebody calculated the other day that it costs more in the federal penitentiary than the Paris with an inmate there in Senator Howe. So it's not on the bad that there's any moral compulsion about this, but the cost of jailing people today is what bothers me. But somehow or other, to tie this to the tool of production, the people that are in jail, rather than the blacks, the Hispanics, and so on, the most marginalized people, workers in the States, I see that as the hardest point. And if we want to go up and talk about human perfection, come on, I'm scared of that. It almost sounds like fascism. Instead of concentrating, why are these people in jail? Who are they? And what kind of system is it that condemns them? That's the, that's where I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's good. I think we've dealt well with this issue about human perfection, and we should resist it. And I've certainly tried my best to resist it. We need to look at an alternative to that, and the alternative to that is actually not something that is produced in some sort of abstract moral way. It's produced in history, you know. And that's why I don't think what Dick was saying was actually blind utopianism of any kind. You know, it's rooted in history. He's looking at historical trends, and he's saying things are changing. This is how they're changing. This is what you can do with them. That's what you have to do with history. That's all I'm saying. And my argument about pessimism and optimism is that it's a fundamentally ahistorical approach to thinking. Because in the end, you know, some things get better, some things get worse. What you have to ask yourself is, what is it that we can do, given the situation that we're in, given that we want what we want and need what we need? That's what you have to do. Now, I think that, you know, capitalism has got a real crisis of order. It costs too much money to keep order, not just in the prisons, but in the schools. It's costing a great deal of money to provide order through welfare. You know, you mustn't forget that a large function of the welfare state was essentially to keep people in their place, to ensure minimum protection against people falling through the net. But they've now got people sleeping on the streets. They've now got people who come totally outside of the system. And what was the first thing that this government did when it was elected? It established what was called the social exclusion unit. And the social exclusion unit, on the face of it, sounds like a really good thing, because it's looking at all of those people who are drug addicts, have no education at all, illiterate, all these other groups of people, psychiatrically ill, who are out on the loose in society with no one to protect them and nothing to do. But if you look at it another way, social inclusion means you join the system on our terms. It means getting people who previously had disability benefits and saying, go and get a bloody job. You know, we'll find you something. It will be a very low wage. It will be very uninteresting, but we'll get you in there somehow. So it's this attempt to pull people out of the prisons, out of the margins, out of the area of failure from capitalism. And whilst on the face of it, it sounds like a reform that is intended to incorporate people into welfare, is actually an attempt to incorporate people into a tight relationship with capital and exploitation. And so you've got to actually look at why they're spending so much money on this in every one of the advanced countries. And the reason is that they are very scared that this can get worse, that the system can fragment, that people can actually end up falling outside of that area of control, and they are now more interested in control than they're interested in ownership.
I mean, firstly, privatisation of prisons in this country is nothing new. Lord Sidmouth of Devon dug out his whole lake building on his property from prisoners of the Republic of Horus, who used his property to cheap labour. So, you know, that's nothing new in this country. In terms of maintaining prisons, I mean, it's actually going in reverse in some sense, because in London, in Dulwich, where Thatcher lived at one stage, the estate is actually like the prison where it was maintained. There's a growth of places, called Paso Robroso in America, whereby they've got golf estates within the premises and security guards and cameras. So the rich become the imprisoned. other point I'd like to pick up on is we talked about cooperation as opposed to competition. It's interesting where competition is supposedly a buzzword, and yet recently Smith, Pine, Beecham and Galaxo said that they needed to combine their efforts because too much was being wasted in competition. So it's interesting how capitalism actually rebuilds its forts. And the system is being rebuilt, it's masses, and no one can see more how capitalism doesn't work on behalf of workers when the mines were closed in this country and now recently with Rover Coals. So the system does rebuild itself. If competition was the panacea, then in business schools throughout the world, you wouldn't teach teamwork and competition, you would teach people to go off and do their own thing, and it would all come right. So I think the system does expose itself, and that's so obvious.
No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think capitalism is not actually interested in competition. It's interested in monopolies, which is cheaper to run. But capitalists are interested in competition because you've always got some sections of the capitalist class who say, you know, there's some rich pickings there. I want to get in on that. So you have a constant tension between a natural tendency towards monopoly on the one side and a natural, not a natural, but a social interest, an economic interest on the part of capitalists to get their share. And that's what generates much of the competition that we see. But also, of course, competition is a beautiful myth for capitalism. You know, the mythology of competition is a bit like the mythology of the market. You know, I remember Jeremy Seabrook in the 1980s once wrote about the market. He said, what a wonderful thing, because the average person thinks of the market, they think of this little, you know, cobbled square and people going out and selling fruit. And, you know, so the market had this sort of rather nice, we go to the market, we buy, we check that the apples are nice and green, and then we buy them. And similarly, the notion of competition sounds sort of rather like, you know, the playing fields of Eton, and we all go out and the best man won, and blah, blah. Whereas in fact, we know that in the history of capitalist competition, you have had people shot, killed, you know, quite aside from the wars, you know, you've got sabotage, you've got the security systems, you've got, you know, every one of these companies organizing themselves behind locked doors. They've now got all kinds of internal regulations corporately against their own employees finding out what they're up to. So what you have, far from active competition, is a very, very vicious, nasty, highly regulated system which purports to be competitive because it's part of the mythology of capitalism. It's part of what you might want to call the capitalist utopian view of itself, that it's about fair competition and the best man winning.
You said something interesting to me when you said I'm all interested in you, but one thing in particular, when you said that we shouldn't start making decisions, we should concentrate on the economic place of socialism, capitalism is so efficient. Well, I mean, that's the easy thing, really. I mean, because it's like dead easy to demonstrate. I mean, you can point out all the ways there are for capitalism. And, you know, you can actually sort of suggest by doing that, you know, what people could add, you know, how they could live, you know, just devoting their time to providing for themselves collectively. And you do it, and don't take any notice. And this leads me back to what you touched on at the beginning of your talk about we are held responsible for our characters. The society we live in has no bearing on how we turned out, and we must be able to work for it. If we make a mistake in the eyes of those that are reaching the fault, we are guilty. And we're told all about how human beings are warlike, how we're greedy, how we're nasty, how we're rich, violent, and all the sort. And how, you know, given half a chance, we slip it broken too far. And what that does, along with like the Christian religion, you know, telling us that, you know, we've got to compare ourselves to God and find ourselves unworthy. And then the way they have a go at our sexuality, they're telling us that that's inappropriate, you know, this is sinful. What human beings do is they get this, so they look around the world and they think, well, this is me, this is, I'm a human being, this is what human beings do. And they feel guilty. And this guilt is like a payment, and what we want to do, we try and project it and transfer it. Like, you know, we're covered in this slick, and we try and rub it off on one another, you know, just to get rid of it. And you know, so that's why we've got all these pejorative names for it. What we're doing is we're saying, when we call somebody an arsehole, we're saying two things. We're saying, first of all, you are, secondly, and importantly, we're not. And I think what happens is this guilt, when you give people, like, you know, you give the economic case and some idea of potential, this guilt thinks, well, we can't do that, we're not up to it, we're not worth it. And it's guilty people don't make revolution. And I think this is something we've got to explore. We've got to explore our capitalism, like, robs us of our vigor, of an idea of our own self-worth. And that's what we have to attack. We have to really, in a sense, find out who we are.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's extremely interesting analysis of the situation, particularly about guilt, about which I think you're quite right. But I think that what I want to say is that not simply that we just put a simple economic explanation, although I do think that, although it sounds rather mantra-like, what the Socialist Party needs to do is probably commit itself to the perpetuation of almost one phrase, and that is production for use is better than production for profit. I actually think if you get that argument across, production for use is better than production for profit, then this system becomes unworkable. You know, you cannot actually reform the system if production for profit doesn't work. You have to get rid of it. So, you know, my own view is that's a position. Now, I'm not suggesting for a moment that you don't deal with the implications of all of that, and you don't talk about the fact that in a society of production for use, we will not have markets, we will not have wages, we will not have money. Furthermore, I don't think you need to confine yourself to the sphere of negatives. You can say positive things as well, although, as I think Marx was right in saying, you should be careful about creating recipes for the cook shops of the future, because it is not for us to impose upon a liberated society pictures of how it will work. Although I have certainly my aspirations, my imagination, my sense of what it would be like. I think, however, the bigger point that you are making is that in order to do any of this, you need a fundamental change in human consciousness away from self-reproach, guilt, and in fact, individuated attributions of fault, essentially. Fault lies in society. It's an extremely unpopular thing to say outside of this room, but it's fundamentally right. You know, when people grow up to become antisocial in one way or another, as all of us do in one way or another, including many of the people who are dishing out the moral judgments about those who are acting criminally, there is a tremendous temptation for people to explain that in terms of the mythology of individual guilt, sin, worthlessness. And what we have to do is to offer encouragement to people to rely upon what their collective human activities can achieve. We have to be constantly looking for those occasions where people achieve, where they sustain healthy life, friendly life, secure life, which most of us do most of the time against all of the odds. That is the key point. You know, for every child who gets beaten up by their parents, abused by their parents, or whatever, there are literally tens and hundreds of thousands of other children who are brought up against all of the odds of poverty, of frustration, of the difficulties of living in a world where things go wrong, who are actually brought up to become hugely successful just because they grow up, just to grow up into adulthood. You know, in a society where we do have wars, where we've had Auschwitz, we've had the gulags, we've had all of that, what we have had above all has been, far outnumbering every concentration camp and gulag, has been the building of hospitals, you know, has been the building of libraries, has been the building of all of those things that are civilizing and enriching, usually against all the odds, usually underfunded, usually staffed by people who are not treated very well, who do terrific jobs, work hard, attempt to encourage one another, and have a great degree of collective strength. And one of the things that socialists have to do is build on that sense of confidence, strength, solidarity, collectivity. I mean, I think it is hugely important, because what you say about guilt, self-reproach, worthlessness is really important. And that is why it is still the case that one of the great enemies of socialism are those religious ideologies that seek to undermine people's self-confidence. And if we can build on autonomous action at every level of society, I think that's how you actually create the sort of people who bring about the sort of change that we're talking about.
So,
You mentioned John Lennon's Imagine a couple of times.
Yeah.
He's become a classic in his last few years.
Yeah.
One line is, you can call me a dreamer. Yeah. Maybe I am. Do you think it's perhaps a socialist, I guess, utopian dreamers?
Well, what do you mean, just utopian dreamers?
Or are utopian dreamers, not realists.
Well, what do you think?
I think they are dreamers.
You do? So why are you asking me what I think? Do you want company? Do you want company in your misery? I mean, I think we're not. I think if I was just a utopian dreamer, then I'd go away and be a just a utopian dreamer somewhere on my own. I wouldn't bother other people. But I mean, what Morris says about this, he says, look, one man with an idea in his head is in danger of being considered a madman. Two men with the same idea in common may be foolish, but can hardly be mad. 10 men sharing an idea begin to act. 100 draw attention as fanatics. 1,000 and society begins to tremble. 100,000 and there's war abroad. And the cause has victories, tangible and real. And why only 100,000? Why not 100 million and peace upon the earth? You and I who agree together, it is we who have to answer that question. I mean, if I were you, I'd spend less time worrying about whether people who are socialists are utopian dreamers, and ask yourself about people who are not socialists. Because the people who are not socialists, and the people who don't think there's ever going to be any change, and the people who are stuck with, you know, super glue to this current social system, I would say they're not utopian dreamers whatsoever. They're realistic wankers. What they are is actually sort of wedded to something for which they have no escape. Their fantasies are sterile and redundant and hopeless.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That almost put the question when you discuss utopia, putting the cart before the horse, without first basically concentrating and attacking the class about it, saying, look, this is where we have to concentrate our efforts. You mentioned there about devising recipes for bookshops of the future. You can't. That has to be left to liberation. The task before us now is liberation. And to go beyond that, don't you need to leave yourself over to some of our...
Yes, I do. I think you do. I think that's why a socialist party should not draw a map of what socialism is going to be like. And of course, if I were less generous than I am, I could mention certain political parties which call themselves socialists, which have drawn a map of what socialism will be like. But, you know, this socialist party takes a view that it has one job, and that is to oppose capitalism and to propose the establishment of socialism. And what people do in a socialist society is up to them. I know what I'm going to do in a socialist society if I get the chance. You know, but I mean, you know, but who knows what that will be? Who knows whether I will ever live in it? Who knows whether my only role in it will be to gasp my last breath and die? Who knows? You know, all that one can say is that in any particular moment in history, it is worth asking yourself the question, do I want to be organized in a society the way it is, or do I need something different? If I need something different, work to achieve it. If you achieve it, you decide how you want to live in it then, and you act upon it. But, you know, the point about it is that the battle between capitalism and socialism is not a battle of abstract values. It is a battle of about needs, rooted in material need. And the problem with this society is not that it fails simply on the level of abstract value. It fails on the level of material need.